Hello and welcome to today's podcast from the Video Journal of Neurology. We are an open access video journal sharing the latest news in neurology across all major disciplines. Our regular podcasts will bring you exclusive insights from renowned experts on hot topics in their fields. In this episode, our experts will be discussing mechanical thrombectomy and the role of bridging intravenous thrombolysis and intraarterial thrombolysis as rescue therapy. Should mechanical thrombectomy be done with or without prior intravenous thrombolysis is an era-defining question in stroke care. And as the debate continues, Urs Fischer, Ivo Roos, and Adnan Qureshi share their insights on the latest data. Starting us off, Urs Fischer and Ivo Roos discuss the findings of an individual patient data meta-analysis looking at direct mechanical thrombectomy versus bridging intravenous thrombolysis with Ultiplase, which pooled data from all six major randomized trials addressing this question.
I think it's important to notice that everything we told today is only regarding patients which are directly presented to a comprehensive stroke center. So all the six trials which were included in our meta-analysis included only patients which were directly brought to a comprehensive stroke center, so a center capable of doing both intravenous treatment and endovascular treatment. Our data is not telling something about patients being transported to a primary stroke center. A primary stroke center capable of intravenous thrombolysis, the patients over there should be treated with intravenous thrombolysis when suitable as quickly as possible. That's something I want to say up front. So what we did is that we took the data from the six trials all over the world, which were looking at the same thing, whether bridging therapy with intravenous thrombolysis and endovascular treatment was still, let's say, better than going for direct thrombectomy. What we did is that we used all the data, we put it together, and what we saw is that the difference is not that different. Urs is going to tell you exactly what we did for the analysis. But the problem is that we're not talking about superiority of one of the other treatments. We're talking about non-inferiority. And that's always very difficult to understand. When you talk about non-inferiority, you need to talk about the boundary of non-inferiority. In this case, we choose for a boundary of 5%, which was a boundary which we got from interviewing many experts in the world. We published a paper on that, and they said, well, if the treatment with going directly for endovascular treatment is not more than 5% different, then I would go for this direct treatment. But if you can't show that the difference is, let's say, less than 5%, if it's going to be, then we should stick with the standard treatment, which is the combination. So we chose the 5% difference for this non-inferiority design. And that's how we started, and that's how we did the analysis. And maybe, Urs, you can tell what we did find.
Yeah, thanks. So overall, there were 1,153 patients in direct mechanical thrombectomy arm, and 1,160 patients received bridging thrombolysis. So overall, there was, on a first glimpse on the Grotter bars of the distribution of the modified ranking scale, there was a trend that patients with bridging thrombolysis performed better than patients treated with direct mechanical thrombectomy. However, the so-called adjusted Kammert odds ratio was 0.89. And in the 95 confidence interval was from 0.76 to 1.04. So this difference was not statistically significant. However, we were not able to show the non-inferiority of the direct mechanical thrombectomy approach compared to bridging thrombolysis. So what does that mean? And what is the clinical implication? So basically, we could not show that direct mechanical thrombectomy is better. However, we could not show that it is equally effective. And therefore, most people and most physicians in the future, they will continue treating patients with large vessel occlusion with intravenous thrombolysis, and then will proceed with endovascular therapy. However, if you look at the subgroups, the rates of good functional outcome defined as modified ranking scale of 0 to 2 was 49% in the direct mechanical thrombectomy group and 51% in the bridging arm. So that's only a difference of 2%, which was statistically not significant. However, what we could show that successful reperfusion was significantly better in patients receiving bridging thrombolysis compared to direct mechanical thrombectomy. However, rates of any intracerebral hemorrhages were higher in the bridging arm than in the direct mechanical thrombectomy arm, but not symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhage. So that means that if you treat patients with a large vessel occlusion, you have a small benefit regarding better reperfusion in patients with bridging thrombolysis. However, you have to pay that with an increased risk of any intracerebral hemorrhage.
We followed up with Dr. Fisher and Dr. Roos, asking what more is needed to be done to close the debate of whether direct mechanical thrombectomy is equally effective as bridging.
We have randomized 2,500 patients and in all these trials, and still the difference in between the two treatment groups is very small. So basically, we could not prove that there is a reason to skip intravenous thrombolysis in all these patients. However, the benefit of the bridging thrombolysis is very tiny and very small. In the IRIS collaboration, there was so far no clear subgroup which had a major benefit of either direct mechanical thrombectomy or bridging thrombolysis. However, we will perform further subgroup analysis in order to see whether there are patients who have a benefit either of direct mechanical thrombectomy or bridging thrombolysis.
Yeah, the issue we are looking at right now is that we are doing a study. We were doing six trials, and now we're doing the meta-analysis. And what we are trying to do is look whether there is still a benefit of the intravenous treatments. And for getting rid of a treatment, the statistics are much more complex. But the statistics for non-inferiority makes it also harder to get rid of, let's say, a standard treatment which is already there, and that's because we are much more afraid of losing a treatment which was proven effective in the past. And you're afraid of losing that because of you're doing your study and you're doing your meta-analysis and you're getting the wrong answer. So you want to be very sure that you're absolutely certain that you can get rid of this proven effective treatment. So the statistics for a non-inferiority design are different than for a superiority design. So let's imagine that the world around, let's imagine that we would have at first endovascular treatments, and that right now somebody would come along and say, hey, I have a potent drug, which is a lytic drug, and you should add it to endovascular treatment. If that would have happened and we would have used the normal statistics, like we always do, the 5% confidence limit and the 95% confidence limit and 5% difference, then we would have ended up with six trials showing no beneficial effects of the intravenous thrombolysis. We would have done the meta-analysis, which have shown the same results, no beneficial effect of thrombolysis, and we would have never added intravenous thrombolysis to the standard treatment of endovascular treatment. But now the world is around. The world is that we have the standard treatment, which is the combination, and with the current trials and with the current meta-analysis, we can't say that the combination treatment we can't say that direct endovascular treatment is as good as having the combination treatment. So we have to stick to the standard treatment, which is the combination. That's the real world.
Adnan Qureshi of the University of Missouri-Columbia also spoke at the World Stroke Congress on the current evidence on whether IVT provides any additional benefits beyond what mechanical thrombectomy is capable of alone. Here is his helpful review of the evidence.
So this is actually a question of the time. As you know, that for several years, The classic paradigm had been that patients with acute ischemic stroke who meet the criteria for intravenous thrombolysis receive intravenous thrombolysis, and then subsequently, if they meet the criteria for mechanical thrombectomy, they undergo thrombectomy. However, it's also been recognized that mechanical thrombectomy is the main way of achieving recanalization and reestablishing blood flow to the ischemic region of the brain. And it's becoming questionable whether intravenous thrombolysis contributed anything beyond what mechanical thrombectomy could not achieve by itself. And obviously, there is a cost issue with intravenous thrombolysis, and there is also a risk issue. So obviously the risk of intracerebral hemorrhage after the treatment may be higher if patients have received intravenous thrombolysis in addition to receiving mechanical thrombectomy. Now, the other side of the story is that if mechanical thrombectomy can be provided in a time-efficient manner, then probably that is the best way to do it. However, in many places, particularly in the United States, where the care paradigm requires patients to present in one hospital, receive intravenous thrombolysis, and then be transferred to a comprehensive stroke center, there is a certain amount of time that is elapsed in these transfers, and perhaps instead of having no treatment, intravenous thrombolysis may still be of value. So now we have four randomized clinical trials that actually showed that in patients who actually are randomized to intravenous thrombolysis with mechanical thrombectomy versus those who receive thrombectomy without receiving any intravenous thrombolysis, the outcomes are the same. The rate of functional independence is no different. However, the field is changing. So while on one hand, you have that evidence that exists right now, which would support that in places where treatment can be provided expediently, mechanical thrombectomy can be done in a time-efficient manner, intravenous thrombolysis may not be necessary. However, the field is changing, and one of the things to recognize is that intravenous thrombolysis is also changing. So the classic intravenous thrombolysis used to be with alteplase, and now there is the third generation thrombolytic tenecteplase. And there's already evidence coming in that patients who get intravenous tenecteplase and get mechanical thrombectomy do better than patients who get intravenous alteplase and get mechanical thrombectomy. So as the use of intravenous tenecteplase is increasing all over the world, including United States, the group that received intravenous thrombolysis and mechanical thrombectomy may not be the same, and they may already be achieving a better functional independence or better outcomes in terms of functional independence. So we have to account for that change. And the most recent trial, the direct save actually allowed patients to get intravenous tenecteplase if that was the institutional standard of care. And what you see is the group that receives intravenous thrombolysis, which could be intravenous tenecteplase, and that mechanical thrombectomy appear to do better than the group that actually achieved or was randomized to mechanical thrombectomy alone. The other thing, obviously, is the trial design. Almost all these trials were designed to be non-inferiority trials. And the non-inferiority margin, meaning that the difference, the magnitude of difference that would actually allow you to conclude that one treatment is not inferior to the other, or actually is equivalent to the other, is very important where you define that margin. And these trials have used very large margins. So you'd have to have a very large difference between the two groups, intravenous thrombolysis with mechanical thrombectomy versus mechanical thrombectomy alone, to say that, well, they are not equivalent. And perhaps the minimally or clinically important difference may be much smaller. So I think that there is some design issues, perhaps in the interest of recruiting less patients, but nonetheless, the precision of estimate or the confidence about the findings of the study, you know, also are of less rigor. So that's kind of where we are right now with intravenous thrombolysis before mechanical thrombectomy. I think it's also important to mention that the guidelines, almost all the guidelines, particularly the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association guidelines, still emphasize that intravenous thrombolysis be given in any patient who's a candidate for intravenous thrombolysis prior to mechanical thrombectomy. And after the results of the direct safe trial, it appears unlikely that those guidelines will change. And the current standard will still remain intravenous thrombolysis before mechanical thrombectomy. I think that change will be prompted if intravenous tenecteplase, one is more widely available, and a trial that actually compares intravenous tenecteplase with mechanical thrombectomy, with mechanical thrombectomy alone, and equivalence is demonstrated with a clinical trial design that actually has enough precision of estimate, and the findings can be, or one can be very confident about the findings themselves based on the statistical design, only then I think the practice paradigm will actually change. I do think that there's also a cost issue that we need to be aware of, that intravenous thrombolysis followed by thrombectomy actually is more expensive than mechanical thrombectomy alone. So in the event that both are actually equivalent, I think that mechanical thrombectomy alone may be the way to go, or maybe the most cost efficient way to go forward.
In the last few years, there has also been a growing interest in the use of intra-arterial thrombolysis, a technique that was largely overshadowed by the introduction of mechanical thrombectomy as standard of care. Adnan Qureshi discusses new studies that are looking at the concomitant use of intra-arterial thrombolysis to optimize reperfusion after thrombectomy.
So, interestingly, there is a renewed interest in intra-arterial thrombolysis. Obviously, when endovascular treatment for acute ischemic stroke was first initiated, it initiated with intra-arterial thrombolysis, meaning it was simply putting a microcatheter and injecting thrombolytic medication into the clot. And then as the devices for mechanical thrombectomy became more and more effective, intravenous thrombolysis kind of became some people actually used to give intravenous thrombolysis. Some actually just relied on using the devices alone. But now there is actually new data coming in that when patients actually get mechanical thrombectomy, there's two groups of patients. So one actually have no recanalization despite multiple efforts with mechanical thrombectomy. And then the second group, actually, you actually open the occluded blood vessel with mechanical thrombectomy, but nonetheless, the tissue perfusion is not normal. There is occlusion at microvascular and small vessel level, which obviously mechanical thrombectomy cannot do anything further, but nonetheless, that is actually preventing the tissue from receiving the appropriate oxygen or appropriate blood supply. So the tissue still is at risk for ischemia. And now the thought process is that maybe we should combine them together. So we do the mechanical thrombectomy, and we also do intra-arterial thrombolysis at part of the procedure. Obviously, there is some initial data to support that, yes, that practice would actually be superior to mechanical thrombectomy alone. More data is required. I think it's also required that which patients intra-arterial thrombolysis is of most benefit. Are these patients who have no recanalization after mechanical thrombectomy, and then intra-arterial thrombolysis will actually assist in recanalization? Are these patients who have recanalization of mechanical thrombectomy, but the results are suboptimal, and there is still a risk of tissue ischemia because the microvessels and small vessels have not recanalized? And then how do you make that judgment that a tissue perfusion is adequate or not based on a classic angiogram, which may not be sensitive enough to detect these abnormalities? So I think that's where the field is heading. I think that the question about intravenous thrombolysis prior to mechanical thrombectomy still remains an open question. I think that mechanical thrombectomy, and a lot of people are using the term optimization, that we have to optimize mechanical thrombectomy. And if optimization means administering intra-arterial thrombolytics to achieve the best tissue perfusion, then essentially we have to incorporate that as part of mechanical thrombectomy.
Those were all the updates we had for you today. Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed listening to today's podcast, and if you found it useful, we would love it if you could leave a review. To make sure you don't miss any future episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. Head to vjneurology.com for lots more content from the World Stroke Congress, including news on tenecteplase use, artificial intelligence, the MrClean late study results, and insights on intensive blood pressure control from the ENCHANTED-2 study. Until next time!